You're listening to The Dice Men Cometh, proudly sponsored by Area 52, Tasmania's largest independent pop culture retailer. Find them at 104 Elizabeth Street, Hobart, or online at area52.com.au.
The Dice Men Cometh!
There's so many games and never enough time, so we had to come back to the studio here on Thursday night, 24th of May 2018, for episode 214 of The Dice Men Cometh here on Edge Radio 99.3 FM. I am Mark.
I'm Garth.
I am Leon, and I have a bear on my shoulder.
You do, but that's just your kind of thing. And it's a naked bear, it must be said as well.
It is. It's a helpful bear, though.
No, Leon's suffering from injuries. Garth, you and I have played a couple of games, and we're going to talk about one of those tonight.
I sure will.
Kickstarter campaign's just wrapping up. I'm then going to have a bit of a chat with you lads, following on from our Spiel des Jahres conversation last week about bad rule books, because the Spiel judges basically came out and said a whole bunch of games weren't considered because of bad rule books. We'll talk about that. And then we've got another new game, newish game, with an Australian link that we're going to talk about after that. And then I reckon
that's
going to be a show.
Leon can go home with his naked bear.
Yeah.
And does the bear say anything?
Not really, no.
No? Okay.
No, it just does what it's told.
Well, that's really, really good to hear. So, look, Leon, you are really cracking on to your 30s, crack being the operative word.
Yep.
You are broken.
I've had one of the worst days of my life today.
There you go.
I've had ultrasounds, I've had x-rays.
Are you pregnant?
It'd probably be a lot easier than what I've gone through today. I nearly passed out and almost had what appears to have been a stroke.
Okay.
So, fun and games all around.
Wow.
I wasn't supposed to be here this week. I was supposed to be at work.
Correct.
Work had one look at me about a week ago and went, oh, no.
So, the Dice Men have had a pretty tough run lately.
Yeah.
I mean, except you, Mark. I've lost a car in a garage.
Yeah.
Leon is now 31 going on 85.
Yeah.
Well, hang on. I got my partner, picked her up at the airport yesterday, and she's almost dead and basically been in bed for a day and a half, and I've been nursing her back to health when I thought I was going to have a couple of days off playing games.
Well, you've chosen to forego games, even though you've said your partner's basically just going to be collapsed and asleep at home.
Oh,
so instead of going and have fun with your mates, he's decided to be the good partner, even though the honeymoon period is well and truly over.
Nice.
I think you've already earned enough brownie points, Mark. But anyway, we need to get into games.
Yes, and I was going to say, speaking of getting into games, you can get into Area 52, because they have games. And Leon, if you're looking for something to do while you're on your back at home, remember they also have your graphic novels and your comics and your trade paperbacks and your, what was the other term I heard for
it?
Well,
if your bear's getting lonely, buy him a Funko Pop.
Sequential art novels or something like this was another term I heard used.
Pretentious little mip.
Anyway, Area 52 has all those options. Get in and check them out. 104 Elizabeth Street, Hobart. Thank them so much for their support of The Dice Men Cometh. And thank you also to Edge Radio. We're going to have a brief musical interlude, and then we'll be back to talk about the games.
That was All I Can Do by Moody Beach on Edge Radio 99.3 FM with the Dice Men Cometh this week, proudly brought to you by our good friends, of course, at Area 52. They have some lovely board games. Garth has bought some recently. They have some lovely graphic novels. I have bought some recently. And Mark probably goes in there and looks at the Funko Pops and goes, well, if only I was 70 years too young.
That's right. Exactly.
Anyway, you lads got together at the pub the other night without me because, you know, that's just the way things work.
That's just what we do when you're... Well, it's got stairs, and you probably can't go upstairs anymore.
I have a bung shoulder. My legs are still, you know, whatever. Anyway, I'm on too many painkillers to deal with this.
I may be blind, but I has a cute earring.
Yes. Oh, you have a cute earring, do you? Didn't know you were this kind of thing. Anyway, you talk about a thing. That's what we're here for.
Yeah.
Board games. That's what we do, right?
All right. So, yes, we are talking a board game, and we're talking about a board game that you can't play.
Wicked.
Because it's just on Kickstarter, and right now, there are 28 hours to go, so unless you are a Hobart taxi driver listening to us live or someone else listening to us live, chances are it'll be done by the time this podcast is edited up and sent out to internet land. So, sorry.
but we
might be able to pre-order it.
And we did talk about it in our Kickstarter update. Was that last week or the week before?
And the game we are talking about is Martin Wallace's Lincoln. Now, Martin Wallace, who is an amazing designer who has been from England and moved to New Zealand and is now calling Australia home.
And we call him one of us.
We do. He was very kind enough to put our name forward towards PSC Games, which is the company that produced this, and got a copy sent our way, which is wonderful. So thank you to PSC.
Plastic
thank
Soldier
you to
Company.
Martin. Yeah. Now, Lincoln, as the name suggests, has a big picture of Abraham Lincoln on the front of the box and on the front of the rule book and on the backs of the cards and everywhere. What the rule book doesn't say is what the game's about. So I thought I would just do a whole bit of a Wikipedia of the American Civil War, because right. that is what the game is about. Went from 1861 to 1865. Basically, it's called the War Between States. You had the Southern states, you had the Northern states. They fought each other over several issues, but probably the one that most people associate it with is slavery.
And apologies to our North American listeners mm-hmm. who know this stuff inside and out and probably are shaking their heads about, it was so much more than that, but obviously this is the quick guide.
Well, I was listening to a podcast actually about this not too long ago, and I think the majority of it was states' rights, which then fed into the whole slavery thing. But we're not going to talk about that, because after Leon's conversation about five tribes, we've probably talked about slavery for enough. In a long time.
I'm not the one who kept bringing the bloody thing up all the time. But the fact that it's not in the front of the rule book is kind of mental. I'm going to talk about a game a little bit later that, until I started reading up on it, didn't ever know it had a story, didn't know it had a game world, didn't know any of that stuff, because it's basically a child's game.
Correct.
Whereas Lincoln, about the American Civil War, one of the most important things in human history, probably a paragraph wouldn't hurt to say what was going on.
Anyway, look. It is about the American Civil War. It is designed by Martin Wallace. It is by PSC Games Plastic Soldier Company.
Yeah.
And it is a two-player, fast-paced, relatively light, card-driven war game. In the box, you'll get several decks of cards. You'll get a deck of cards for the Union player. You'll get a deck of cards for the Confederate player. You've got a relatively large board, which is just made up of your East Coast USA. Basically going from the South Florida, and you go into a bit of sort of Savannah and New Orleans as well, all the way up to Washington, and that's going to be the territory that the two players are fighting over.
Yeah.
It is really nicely laid out, because everything that is important on the board, you can read from your side of the board depending on what player you are. So if I'm the Confederate player, everything that I need to know is facing me. And across the board, the Union player, everything faces them. So very nice, easy to see. Now, the decks of cards that you're going to get, there are a little bit of shuffling that you need to do to get it set up. There are cards which are number one and number two cards, and they'll only come into the game as you progress through the game and have to shuffle your deck. Now, shuffling the deck does become a bit of an issue, because one of the ways that the Union player will lose is if they have to do their third reshuffle, game over, immediate game over. We'll get to that, though. So what is this game? This is a game for control and a game for who'll win the Civil War, I guess. Not historically accurate, but it is what each player is vying for. The way you're going to be doing that is using these cards that are all multi-use, which is really, really cool. And certainly not a unique mechanic. There's a lot of games now that will have cards which are multi-use, but this fits the theme very, very well. Because all of the actions that you'll be able to take are in keeping with the theme.
I'd actually think it'd be quite unique if somebody brought out a game these days saying, yes, you've got a deck of cards you can pick cards from, and each card does one thing.
Yep.
One thing only, and that's it. Like, this is crazy talk. Not since the days of poker have we seen such insanity. And even still, you can use that for 100 different games. So yep. There you go.
And we have seen card-driven war games. Obviously, you know, Twilight Struggle and the Coin Series before. But I haven't seen, and we look, you know, I'm not a huge war game aficionado, but I haven't seen the multi-use where it's, you know, all those other games had you use it for points or you use it for the thing on the card.
Yeah.
This has more than that. So I haven't seen that in a war game before. So again, I think Martin Wallace did this before in A Few Acres of Snow.
Yeah.
Taken something out of the general hobby board game world and brought it into the war game world.
Correct. Now, this game, as I said, it has been on Kickstarter. It smashed it. It was about 400 and something percent, which is great. So it's wonderful that it's going to be out to backers, which is awesome. Yeah, check it out if you do have a chance to listen, like the sound of it. I would hope that you can do pre-orders after the Kickstarter is closed, but we will see. So how do you play this game? Two players, everyone shuffles their cards. Union player will always have a hand limit of 6. Confederate player will start with a hand limit of 5. And that hand limit may go down depending on the blockade function, which is one of the effects that the Union player can do with their cards. And the cards, as I say, have multiple uses. You can use them for deploying armies, and that's going to probably be the way that the game starts with both sides. Each side have armies of strength 1, 2, or 3. They are represented by cardboard chits. And do you know what they have on them, Leon?
Stuff.
Stuff that says 1, 2, or 3, so you can easily tell the strength of each one. The interesting thing, though, is it's cost you more, not surprisingly, to play the larger armies, the 2s and the 3s, because to play a 1 army, you just play and discard the card that up the top says 1 army. You get rid of the card, place your chit wherever you have control, and then move on.
That seems simple enough.
If you want to play an army that is 2 or 3, it's going to cost you a card. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's going to cost you 1 card to place a level 2 army and 2 cards to place a level 3. But the issue is you're not just discarding those cards. Yeah. You are getting rid of them from the whole game for the rest of the game until you decide to play this game again. So this is a really brutal and really full-on way for you to start thinning your deck, because you'll start initially and go, oh, yeah, I can play a level 3 army and get rid of a couple of level 1s that I've got in my hand, because obviously 3 is more than 1, Leon. I learnt that. But you'll very quickly find yourself, and this goes for both sides of the war, that you'll end up with hands which are all good cards.
Yeah.
And you have to make this decision. Do I want to place a strong army because it might give me that extra impetus to have a great fight and a win? But am I going to have to forego a lot of extra cards out of the game forever? And that is really tough. Mark, you should love that mechanic, because you are always a fan of deck builders that allow you to thin your deck really, really quick. This is very much in that vein.
This is like a deck thinner.
It is all deck thinner. So one of the things you can do is you can go out there and deploy your armies. Now, where you can deploy your armies, you have to have control over it. And there are a couple of sort of key ways that you'll know about control, but the easiest way is supply lines. So the North player, the Union player, all their supply ultimately comes from Washington. All of the various places on the board are connected by railway tracks. You have to be able to connect Washington to where you want to play without having any breaks in your control. So there can't be anywhere that the Confederate player has control of. For the Confederate player, they can draw resources from a couple of areas, so a little bit more flexibility to move your armies around. But the main way is always just having a look at those railway lines. So that's what you're doing. Second thing is you can move those armies around, and there will be basically an icon on the card that has the movement icon, which is a picture of a train. Mm-hmm. You play that and you can move an army. Very, very simple. You can move one army anywhere you've got control, or you can move multiple armies one space adjacent. Very, very straightforward. You can then start a fight. Now, fighting in this game is tough.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you win or lose. It's bloody tough. And the reason it's tough is because each player only gets to do 2 actions. Now, you do get to do as many free actions as you can, and there's certainly cards that will allow you to do free actions, but not a huge number.
Not a lot.
So for the most time, you're going to be doing 2 actions, and one action might be build an army, and that makes that one particular area stronger, and then your second action might be moving that army into a conflict, which will automatically create a combat. Now, when there is combat, a couple of things will happen. The main thing is you'll easily be able to see the strength of the 2 armies, because the Union player will be able to add up the value of the chits that they've got. The Confederate player will be able to do that, and you'll kind of get a lay of the land. Then you've got the ability to play some free action cards, potentially. You might have some that will offer you bonuses for moving some extra armies into the conflict zone, or buffing your defense by a couple of action points, or something like that effect. And then both sides have to play a card face down. Doesn't matter if you don't have any cards in your hand, you just basically take one from the top of your deck and play it face down. Because on a lot of the cards, you've got a leadership score. Leadership score, very simply, add your army strength, add any modifiers, add your leadership score. Whoever's got the biggest number is going to win that combat.
So there's a nice little bit of hidden information there. So just it's enough. Not, you don't look and go, well, I've got 10, you got 5, I win.
Correct.
You just don't know. And the leadership scores seem to be between like 1 and 5.
1 and 5 generally, yeah. So you add those up and then both sides are going to suffer because the losing side has to get rid of half the number of chits that they have got in the battle, rounded up. So if they've got 5 chits, they'll lose 3. The winning team loses half the number rounded down. So it doesn't matter who wins this. Everyone is going to lose. And the key thing is it's the number of chits. It's not the number of points on the chits. It is the number of chits. So if you've got 4 3 strength armies, which is a lot and has cost you a lot of cards to place, you're going to lose potentially 2 of those straight away, whether you win or lose. It's tough.
And I think from my very, very limited knowledge of the American Civil War, I think that is truly reflective of what happened because it was a brutal war with huge amounts of casualties on both sides.
Yeah.
So it's not like the, you know, battles we see now where, you know, 100 people go in, take out 1,000 lowly armoured troops and they lose, you know, 5 people. It was like casualties were very, very high on both sides.
That was because we used to have the days with the whole shoot a musket and then wait to get shot.
Correct. And
then
and shoot walk back in a nice line.
Which, outside of World War One, is the scariest war, I think, in human history, because bugger that.
Yes. Well, we're all too old to be drafted. Well, Mark and I are. You're an invalid now, so you'll be fine.
Hey!
So, look, you'll go through this, and the way you win, look, the game is divided up into sort of 3 eras, 3 bits, I guess, and they are really determined by the Union player and the reshuffling because for the Union player not to lose, they have to have scored 2 victory points by the time they shuffle the first time.
Yeah.
Then they need to have got 5 victory points by the second time. And then if it gets to the third round and they need to shuffle, they have to have at least 12 victory points in order to not automatically lose. Now, the way the Confederate player will win is they have to take Washington, which is all the way at the other end of the map, which they can do sometimes, or they kind of just have to win enough battles against the Union.
Yeah, they basically have to stop
and
the other side
survive.
From winning. Hang in there.
They just have to survive and survive. They can have as many reshuffles and many redraws as they can. There's not that ticking clock of advancement, which is what the Union player has. They have to basically go from the north down the south, taking victory point after victory point, because various areas, various towns, I guess, are worth either no points or 1 point or sometimes 2 points. And really, you're just going to go back and forth over that. Now, this game says 90 to 120 minutes. Mark and I managed to play it twice in an hour.
Yes.
And that was really made up of one 45-minute game and one 15-minute game. But before we get to that, because we did play a preview copy, Mark, tell me about your thoughts on this.
Yeah, so I was fascinated to play this because I did really enjoy A Few Acres of Snow.
Sure.
Obviously, I'm a huge deck builder fan, and that was a war game that brought in the deck builder mechanic to simulate the fact that it takes you a while to build up your forces in a war. And this has a not that similar thing, but it has where you're bringing in those extra decks. And the interesting balance where for the Union Army, those decks they bring in are sort of getting stronger and stronger. And with the Confederate Army, the decks that they're bringing in are actually weaker and weaker, showing that they're losing support, that they don't have the resources and the help coming even from internationally.
Correct.
To help them go the long haul. So, I had fun.
Yep.
I'm not a huge war game man. What I saw, so the first game was very much you moved, I almost mirrored your move.
Correct.
And because you were the Union Army, you had that pressure of I need to get those 2 victory points before the first shuffle.
Yeah, I need to get victories on various battles because there's basically no dead space. There's nowhere that you can just put an army and sort of just let it rest there.
Yeah, it's not
there's
like
there's a front line where everyone is putting everything, and then it's got to try and move for the north player. It's got to move south to get those victory points. Otherwise, the game's going to end in about 20 minutes.
It's not like
or 15, possibly.
You've got allies in France, The axis in Germany, and there's Belgium in the middle, or Switzerland, or whatever, where it's a neutral country, where you've got some space to move. It's like the line is there, and we're right on it right from the start. So that first game where I was the Confederates, I knew all I had to stop you from doing was getting those two victory points.
Yeah.
And so if I just matched you at every turn, it's hard. You've got the movement element, but it's hard to sort of get a leg up.
Correct.
And so that's how I defeated you, was I held out and you couldn't get the 2 points.
And it must be said that as the Union player, there are a couple of other strategies, because some of the cards allow you to do naval movement, which in essence gets an army behind the back lines of the Confederate player. But that's bloody difficult to make work too.
Yeah.
There's also, as I said, the blockade, where the Union player, if they play the right cards, can reduce the hand limit of the Confederate player, which can mess up their ability to draw cards, of course.
And that sort of brings me to the second game where, obviously, I didn't want to make the mistake that you made,
you didn't get
those victory points. So, firstly, I was trying to get your hand limit down with the blockade, but then secondly, I thought, okay, instead of like matching, I'll do this tricky thing where I'll pull out of a couple of places and pile everything into one and smash through your lines and get a victory point.
A victory point, yes.
Which I did very successfully and took you by surprise.
Correct.
Unfortunately, that then left me weak in a couple of spots.
Yep.
One of which was Washington.
And that kind of... Before we talk about that, have you got anything else to say before we go into this part of the game?
Okay.
Because this is where we switch from the 45-minute version of the game to the 15-minute version.
Yeah, look, I mean, I had a lot of fun. As I said, I haven't played a lot of games, a lot of war games, two-player ones, where it's very much me against you and we're just fighting the whole time. And it's probably not my preferred style of game. And I think that's why I've liked the coin games.
Sure.
With the four players, because the dynamic is much more interesting. Having said that, though, you know, I love Twilight Struggle.
Yeah.
I must say this quickly, because I'm going to blame the painkillers for this, because I missed this opportunity a few minutes ago, so
okay.
I'm going to take it now. I missed an opportunity for a joke.
All right.
Because Mark said he's not really a wargaming man. What I should have said, and what normal Liam would have said, is that because when you're a teenager, you didn't get bitten by a radioactive wargame.
Right.
I've had that in the back of my head for the last 3 minutes. I was like, why didn't I say that?
What's wrong with me? Well, the thing is, you edit the show, so you can go and just chop it up.
I can put what I just said then and put...
So, look, I really enjoyed that first game too. I thought it was tense, and it certainly ebbed and flowed. And I didn't lose because I didn't get the two victory points. I lost because I lost too many battles. And every time the Union player loses a battle, the... is it the political track?
Oh, that's right. Sorry, I forgot.
Goes towards the European strength, or the influence goes closer towards the Confederate side. So I lost because I lost so many battles that the Europeans went, well, clearly the Union suck. We're going to put all our eggs in the Confederate basket.
That's right. You didn't even get to the stage of needing the two victory points.
Correct. But I had fun doing that.
Yeah.
And that was fun. And then we swapped sides.
And I was going to say, and we were like, let's go again.
Correct. And we did that. And then... we discovered a fatal flaw in the game. Mark didn't, I did, through superior tactics. And it is a known issue with this game, which very recently has been addressed and corrected. So it's called the Manassas Hammer. Now, Manassas is a part of the board, a little area, which is directly next to Washington.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, what happens is that Manassas is a Confederate area, so that the Confederate player starts with an army in there, one move away from Washington.
Right.
Now, the Union player starts with an army in Washington as well, and Washington itself, in this preview copy, has an inherent defense of +4.
Oh, yeah.
Which is strong. But it doesn't take long for a very clever Confederate player to just put a couple of 3-strength armies into Manassas. Forget the sort of shenanigans that the Union player is trying to do and get that one victory point somewhere and just go all in for the kill. And that's what happened. I was able to play a railway movement card that allowed me to move 2 3-strength armies from anywhere in my controlled network to the spot. So I moved 2 3-strength armies into Manassas. Second action was attack, and it was destruction and game over in next to no time.
We went from like even... to like 3-1
correct
in that one move.
Yep.
Part of that was because I missed a railway connection that I didn't know you could. But clever card play on your part, Garth. And did you know the reason why it's called the Hammer is because it came from, in a few acres of snow, there was an issue called the Halifax Hammer, which was a similar thing where you basically, if you did a move from Halifax in a certain way, and I can't remember exactly what it was like, it was unbeatable strategy. Now, that was found quite a way after the game came out. And obviously, this one was found during the Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah, and this one has only been discussed by Martin himself on the Kickstarter campaign within the last 24 hours.
Awesome.
So really, really new.
Well, I would argue to say that if this game, the setup at least, is historically accurate, that this probably would have been a concern in the real war, I'm guessing. If they thought, well, next to us is a Confederate colony, what's to stopping them from maybe getting some European allies to just swarm that and then we're gonski straight away?
Which may have been an issue. So what they've done is that they've seemingly in the retail versions and copies that backers will certainly get is the strength of Washington will be upgraded to 10 as an inherent defence, which is massive. And then there's also going to be a couple of other tweaks to a few other sort of, I guess, little rules and adjustments in the game, which will balance that out. So I definitely want to give this another go playing these rules. They weren't around when we played this two, three nights ago.
All right, well, the question I need to ask after what you guys have talked about the game, and it does sound interesting, I would like to play it, but is it balanced? Because you've said a hell of a lot of the Confederate player gets this horrible thing happening to him. You haven't said much the other way.
Well, the interesting thing is the Confederate player just has to survive.
Right.
It just has to survive and basically stop the Union player from getting this constant march of victory points. And the way they're going to be getting victory points is by beating your armies down. So for the Union player, it's just about moving down and down and down and down and down. But for the Confederate player, you really need to grab hold of it early on in the game, build up your armies when your deck is going to be at its strongest, because after the first reshuffle, it will get weaker. After the second reshuffle, it will get weaker again and more diluted. So they've got to really just survive and play the long game, I guess, initially. But they do get to win by going to Washington, and our opinion has to be skewed because getting to Washington through this Manassas Hammer was easy and it was done in 10 to 15 minutes of game time. Mm. That won't happen this time when we go and play it again. So I reckon the updates and the corrections will make it a hell of a lot more balanced. And there's a couple of other tweaks as well.
Yeah.
So I reckon what we do is we print them off, play the game as it should be as of the corrections, and then reassess.
Right. Look, I just quickly want to talk about the production values of this. This game looks absolutely beautiful.
It does.
The art, the colours, the layout of the board, it's really easy to read. The iconography, I couldn't fault any of that in this game, and it makes me excited. I know I read something on the PSC website about they've done a game about the Great War, World War I, which I've always been fascinated by. I'm really anxious to check that out because if going by this production, this is a beautiful looking game. As I said, you know, we've got some tweaks to make for the gameplay to try it again, but just at face value, I was blown away by this.
Yeah, it looks great. And if you like your two-player card games, not necessarily even two-player war games, this will be good. And it was very, very good the first time we played it. The second time, it was different, but that's been fixed, which is great that PSC and Martin Wallace were able to get enough copies out to reviewers, such as us, to be able to provide that feedback before backers get it, play a game maybe twice and go, ugh.
So if somebody gets a copy of this game and really likes that, what you're trying to say is that they can 50% thank Martin Wallace and 50% thank us as well?
Well, it's probably more 60-40.
60-40, okay, that's completely reasonable. And I go with that completely.
Excellent. So that's it. That's Lincoln by Martin Wallace. Another two-player card-driven war game. Definitely, if you hear this within 28 hours of us going live to air and it interests you, go and get it on Kickstarter. Otherwise, we could probably take it to BorderCon and let people play it. Who knows?
Yeah, that's right.
We may just.
And look, so many Kickstarters now, they do have the late pledges, so I wouldn't be surprised at all if they had that. I think this was funded inside the first day.
Yeah, it was really
quick. So, yeah, look, it's definitely worth a check out. Lincoln by Martin Wallace and PSC, Plastic Soldier Company. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk about more issues with rules and what you can do about them, game designers.
Oh.
That was Childish Gambino with Riot on Edge Radio 99.3 FM with the Dice Man Cometh, brought to you by our good friends at Area 52. Go in there and buy stuff. Mark!
Hey, Leon. Pointing at me, yes. Speaking of Childish Gambino.
Yes.
Did you make it to the midnight screening of Han Solo, A Star Wars Story last night?
No.
Ah, I haven't heard anything about it yet, but I know a good friend of the show, Bo, was going to the Wednesday midnight session to see Childish Gambino playing Landau Calrissian.
Yes.
I thought he was playing Donald Glover.
No, that's Donald Glover was playing Landau Calrissian because that's Childish Gambino is his stage name, Garth.
Yes.
Get with the program.
They've never been in the same room at the same time as far as I'm concerned.
There you go.
It's like Michael and LaToya Jackson all over again.
Correct.
Oh, don't go there. Anyway, we have recently had some comments. We mentioned them last week when we were talking about the Spiel des Jahres, the German Game of the Year Award that's very important in our hobby. And there were some comments made by the chair of the jury, Tom Felber. I'm going to quote, not in a German accent.
Good.
We've done it again. Namely, we've played hundreds of games over the course of a year and finally put together a list of especially interesting, entertaining, fun, original and innovative titles in which everyone who plays games will be able to find a game that'll bring joy to them, their family or their social circle, guaranteed. It was a strong year. 23 titles have finally made it onto our list. It could easily have been a few more. We are aware that other great games are missing, but we had to limit ourselves. Unfortunately, we are increasingly under the impression that ever more very good games are being hastily put together at the last minute in order to meet release deadlines, without sufficient attention being paid to the comprehensibility and completeness of their rulebooks. We have never had to rule out so many, in and of themselves, very good games as this year, simply because their rulebooks did not meet the quality we expect. We jury members no longer wish to see ourselves in the role of beta testers for rulebooks, which are only made adequate on the second print run. Several times we have amended the age of and playing duration recommended by the publisher on our recommendation list because they just didn't match our own experience. And just a reminder, he said, Red Pawn, which is the Spiel des Jahres, marks games for everyone, especially people who have little experience in games. Even this group will have little difficulty getting to grips with these games. And the charcoal grey category, that's the colour of the Kennerspiel pawn, is for those players who have a little more experience in learning and applying tactical thinking to rules systems. So clearly what they're saying is, even though these games are for people slightly more advanced, the rules have to be able to be picked up and played out of the box. So I guess, in our experience, we have seen this here at the Dice Man Cometh many times recently since we started being receiving preview copies, particularly for Kickstarter. And in some cases, the designers have said to us straight up that the rules are a work in progress, that's okay, and they send us updates. However, in some other cases, we've had to have long conversations via Twitter, email, etc., about clarifications just to play the game. And in the worst cases, there have actually been times when we have abandoned playing the games.
Correct.
Because of rules. Now, of course, we don't want to put Rodney Smith out of a job because Watch It Played videos have saved quite a number of games for us. And it's great to see designers and publishers using these more. And in fact, Garth, Lincoln had a sheet of paper inside that basically said, stop, don't read these rules, go and watch this video.
Well, I recently borrowed a couple of games off our old friend Trent. I borrowed Alien Frontier and Deus because I've wanted to play them for a while, but I've never actually played them myself. The reason I haven't played them yet is because I could not find any good how-to rule videos on YouTube. And because I'm not going to lie, I cannot remember the last time I read a rule book like cover to cover in preparation for a game. Yeah. I'll watch a YouTube video and then I will look back to the rules if necessary.
Yeah, as a reference.
But it's literally been years since I've read a book from cover to cover. And that's a way, I reckon, especially a lot of younger people these days probably do it. So if you've got an awesome video out there, maybe you could get away with your rule book being... But at the end of the day, if the person that doesn't know your game as good as you can put up a video in 15 minutes explaining the rules, why the hell can't you write it down?
Well, on that note, I bought Stuffed Fables on the weekend.
Yes.
So you guys haven't played it yet. I've been playing it with my kids. And in the rule book, it goes, this is how things work, and next to it is a QR code.
Oh, nice.
You scan the QR code, it goes directly to Rodney Smith, wherever he happens to be at that particular time of the day, and he will very nicely give you...
He calls you up and says, oh, Garth, now.
No, it's a video. He doesn't just call. It will then give you a 30-second to 2-minute video of whatever it is that you're talking about. There's probably 3, 4, or 5 of them dotted throughout the core rule book, which just makes life so much easier, especially when playing games with kids. So I was playing this game with my 7-year-old and my 10-year-old, and we got to a certain situation that hadn't happened before. QR code, played the video. It made sense for everyone who's 7 up to me who's a little bit older than that.
Yeah, and we've said before, there's lots of different ways that people interpret rule books and how you go about them. But I've said for years now that if I open a rule book, this is what I want in the first 3 pages. The first page, I want probably your story, your stuff about the game world, something like that. That's normally your first page. Second page, picture of the board and how it's set up. Maybe A to Z on how you set it up. The next page, how a turn works and how you win the game. If I don't know those 3 things out of the first couple of pages, bugger off.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, you've done your rule book wrong. Because they're the things, when somebody, if you sit down to play a game with somebody that knows the game, so they're not going to read the rule book to you every word, what are they going to tell you?
Yeah.
They're going to set the game up. And they're going to tell you, this is how turn works, this is how you win, this is what the game world's like, and then they'll explain the rules and stuff after. So if they're doing it that way, why on earth should your rule book be any different?
Yeah, and look, I've got a couple of tips, I guess, for aspiring game designers, what to do and what not to do. And I'm sure I'll probably cover those things you mentioned, Leon.
Yep.
So what makes a bad rule book? Some of the things we've seen. Whole sections missing.
Yes.
And where keywords are assumed to be intuitive, like there's a word that sort of means shuffle your deck or do something, and they'd never explain what it actually means, and you expected to know it. Or the opposite thing, which is replacing common usage words like shuffle or deal or your hand or your deck with special words for the purpose of theme that just actually make the whole thing more complicated.
Yes, looking at you, Android Netrunner. Every single word you use. I mean, it's awesome once you know them because it makes that game that's thematic even more thematic. But you try and Trent tried to explain this to me the first time I ever went to the Hobart Game Society, and I thought he was speaking a different language. What are you talking about?
Yeah, well, the thing is, we have maybe slightly different game experiences to a lot of other people purely because we play so many things once.
Yes.
So we are reliant on these rule books to make sense because, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on your point of view, we don't have the time to play a game 20, 30, 40, 50 times and know everything inside and out. Now, that gets a little bit tiring from time to time, but what makes it so exhausting is when you can't just sit down and play. And that's one of the frustrations that we do have, which it's a good problem to have. Having the ability to play a lot of games is wonderful.
Yeah.
Having to play games one time is fun sometimes and challenging, but it isn't always awesome when you just have basic failures in communication from a rule book.
Yeah. Now, a couple of other things. So no FAQ, because always you get through the rule book and then you think, oh, what about this? And if it's not covered in the actual semantics of the rules themselves, you want some examples. You want a glossary or an index to, so you can, when you see those terms again, you can look back.
Or at least a web address to, this is the FAQ on BGG that already has 50 pages of blah, 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 blah. That's at least something.
Yeah, although, and look, BGG again has saved us many a time looking up rules. But as the Spiel jury chair said,
you shouldn't have to.
The people that they're targeting their games to, most of them wouldn't know what BGG is and how to look it up. And, you know, it's not the friendliest of websites for looking up those forums.
Well, it was in the 1850s when it was first launched because it still looks like that.
It is kind of Lincoln Mo's on there, maybe.
It is kind of the equivalent where I've heard some people say, like, oh, this Star Wars film, you'd enjoy it a lot more if you'd read the 3 books that came out in the 80s. Just bugger off. They're films. If I've seen the ones before them, I should know what's going on in this one.
Yeah. Now, we want examples in there that show us how the battle system works, for example. So, you know, any rule book that doesn't have any examples, I'm going to struggle with it. And, of course, a picture tells 1,000 words isn't just a saying. So often it is true, particularly where people have these complicated examples and complicated words. A lot of games are produced by people from other non-English-speaking countries. So if they've got pictures, often you don't have to translate a picture, which is nice. And speaking of translations, Google Translate doesn't cut it. There are so many people out there offering services to translate games. And when you see it on Kickstarter now where people are producing multiple language editions, you've really got to get those translations right.
Well, I think we could use a recent example. So Darwin's Choice, for example, which we played a couple of weeks ago, the game about evolution, creating various creatures, yeah. moving them around, Swiss-based designed and a great game. It was good fun and successfully funded. But it did require a bit of back and forth with the designers to clarify a few bits.
Yeah.
Because the rules were long and wordy and still not 100% clear, which just does detract from the overall experience. Now, again, once you get it and once you know what you're doing, fun times.
Yeah.
But it, you shouldn't have to work at that.
Absolutely. Sorry, Leon, were you going to say something or were you just,
no, I was just
sighing?
Off my own world.
No worries. So,
but correct.
the overlap of flavour and mechanisms, and, you know, flavour shouldn't get in the way of you learning the rules. Now, for me, many of the Czech game editions and the Vlada Chvátal games are a great example of how to implement flavour and rules where they don't cross over too much. And yet we've seen so many others where by trying to make the rules thematic and flavorful, you get to the end of a paragraph and it's like, huh?
Yeah.
You know, particularly when they're using, as we mentioned earlier, those funny words for what is your deck or your hand or your discard.
Good thing is Czech Games Edition have got a history of making good and interesting and funny rule books. So as long as they continue, that's great.
Yeah, and the amount of times I've gotten a brand new game, I've opened it. First thing I do is pick up. Actually, yeah, the first thing I do is I open, get the rule book out, and I just look at how thick it is. And I just straight away go, that straight away tells me, I reckon I'm going to enjoy this, or I'm going to get this to the table soon, or, oh, but Jesus.
Yeah, I wonder how much this is second.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. It seems such a silly thing, but it is absolutely true.
Yeah. Now, proofreading, and again, you know, again, I guess we're maybe a little bit skewed because we have been getting these preview copies. But, you know, not only proofread it yourself, but get other people who aren't involved with your game to proofread it, because it's like the when we read through the rules and we go, well, that doesn't make sense. And then you see a video by someone who's made the game. They talk like everything is common sense and you're still scratching your head thinking, what?
Yeah, because it's common sense to them because they're the ones who came up with it and they've dealt with it a million times. Well, we have played some games where within the first 2 minutes of reading the book, we've had a question. There's no answer for it. We've asked the designer and he said, that's a good question. No one's ever asked that before. Yeah. And we think, that's not possible.
No.
Have you played this outside of two people? If you're saying that, that tells me you've not put it in front of nearly anybody and said, read this and tell me, can you play
it? Well, I think on top of proofreading, it's all about blind playtesting.
Yeah, yeah.
You need to get people who you do not know to sit down with your game where you don't say a word, designer. Here's the rules. Here's the game and the components. Play it.
So the problem is that doesn't really happen. You'll go to conventions and stuff and you'll sit down in front of them and they'll be enthusiastic about their game that they know back to front and they'll explain the rules to you, which is great when you want to learn and play a new game. But for testing purposes,
it needs to be blind play.
Now, look, we see this a little bit now. If you're an artist and your strength is in the art, then despite maybe what you see on Kickstarter, art alone will not carry your game. And we've seen that recently when we've seen games that looked amazing that didn't get funded. And then other games that don't look so amazing and get easily funded. And often it's videos which show the gameplay and people being able to, like, download, print and play, do that sort of stuff to make sure that the game actually works. Now, of course, minis, on the other hand, well, you just stick minis in the game and it's kind of fun.
But Kickstarter is a good example for this, because a good Kickstarter page that has lots of videos and lots of pictures and lots of that kind of stuff, you look at it and you go, wow, that's cool. If it's just a wall of text, you just kind of zone out. Yeah. So it's the exact same with a rulebook. It is no different.
Mm. Yeah, and look, one that's been a big bugbear for us lately, player aids. There's no excuse, I don't think, these days, not to have a decent player aid. And to have a player aid where there's a very – something that you refer to almost every turn is left off, to me that's just inexcusable.
When there's clearly space on a player aid for that information.
Well, that's why I had Food Truck Champion on my list, because the game itself is great and the rules themselves are okay, but the player aid is what puts this game back in its box and back on the shelf. Because it isn't there.
And look, again, I don't want to put Universal Head and the Esoteric Order of Gamers out of work, because they do fantastic rule summaries that look beautiful, look like they've been produced by the same company that made the game. But, you know, look, We shouldn't have to get to that stage to have third parties improve our rules. And look, for more complex games, a classic example we had, Garth, Vitalis Serta had a teaching guide for the Gallerist. Now, that's a very heavy, complex game. Without that teaching guide that you expertly went through, I think we would have looked at that and gone, nah, too hard. But, you know, you basically almost read through it in about 20 minutes, half an hour. And at the end of that, we had a fantastic game experience. So things like that are great. One last one, multiple rule books. Like, you shouldn't have to be flicking between different books to try and find something. Now, I know a lot of people, they like to include maybe a quick start guide, or if you're a scenario-based game, you might have a main book and a scenario book. But I'm talking about, you know, two or three or even four books of rules.
It's crazy.
Now, just a couple more quick examples. Now, there must be something about making a game about Mars, because first Martians and Martians, A Story of a Civilization, the internet just talks about them terribly for how hard it is to play those games straight out of the box. Zombicide, now, you guys played the medieval version recently.
Yes.
The first and second editions of Zombicide, I hear, were absolutely terrible for their rules. And I guess that shows how a designer can improve them over iterations.
Yep.
And like Lincoln, many war games, because they're more complicated, because they're almost simulations rather than just a game, they are often very difficult to put in the rule books. And hats off to GMT, who do this really well with their paragraph numbering, although sometimes it is a bit scary when it says, look up paragraph 1.2.5.7.A.B.
Very true.
But, you know, they have great glossaries and indexes and cross-referencing, I think. They do that really
and
well.
And it's also with the GMT coin games especially, once you play one, you can then go on and play the seven or eight other ones that they've released, because the mechanics are all very, very similar.
A couple more quick ones. Fantasy Flight games, and they have got better over the years, but some of those were shocking.
Yeah, Android. Oh, my God.
And Phil Eklund games.
Oh, I had that on my list here, a bunch of games.
A game because, you know, they are quite complicated. You know, a little tiny game, and they're so complicated. How many times have we gone to play a couple of those and just gone, no.
And it's 100% right. And I mean, it must be very clear that we're not saying complicated rule books are the issue.
No.
Complicated rule books are completely fine because the games warrant that. It's when you don't have a basic understanding. So having simple things like your glossary, like your FAQ, like a sample turn, and what's happening more and more in games like Fog of Love, you just have a bloody tutorial session, which is, this is how the game plays.
That's a perfect example.
And you play it, and that gives you that really clear understanding of it, because there's a whole bunch of science around how people learn, and people learn visually, or people learn by listening, and people learn by doing and all that. So if you're just there doing the tutorial, and I don't think there is a better one than you'll find in Fog of Love, it just is so much more immersive. It's great.
I mean, video games have been doing that literally for 40 years.
Yeah.
The first level is either flat-out says tutorial, or it's the first level. It's pretty simple. You do the mechanics that you're going to do for the next 20 hours.
Yep.
At least once you get the idea. Why on earth has it taken board games so long to get onto
that train? And again, Stuffed Fables, which is designed for a kid's game, the first story, of which there are seven in it, just every sort of chapter within the story introduces one more mechanic. Gives every player a time to figure it out, to get your head around it and go on. So I want more of that, please.
Yeah, fantastic. Anyway, game designers, no more excuses. We'll take a very quick break and we'll be coming back with a wrap-up.
Hello, everyone. Sorry to interrupt, but it is your friendly neighbourhood Leon here. I just wanted to take a few seconds to remind our old listeners and to all our new that you can support The Dice Men Cometh on Patreon. You can jump over to thedicemencometh.com and there is a link sitting there on the front page. You can give as little or as much as you want every month, and we are very, very appreciative. I myself do it for several different podcasts, and a dollar or two comes out and I don't even notice. And I can tell you right now that if everyone listening to my voice right now only gave us a dollar every month, we would be very, very happy, lads. And every cent that you spend goes straight back into the show. We've been using it, as well as the advertising from our lovely sponsors, to go all around Australia to see you guys at every convention we can get our hands on, and hopefully we might even be doing it internationally soon, so watch this space. Also, you could jump over to redbubble.com and search for Dice Men, and you can get our logo onto all different kind of merchandise. We ourselves have them on t-shirts and hoodies and coffee cups and stuff, and they're really cool, and that's another way you can support us as well. The show has grown leaps and bounds in the last year or so, and it is thanks to the effort and support of you lovely people out there. You keep giving and keep giving us material, and we will keep doing the show. So, love to all of you, and now back to the action.
Nah, but yeah, that was Mesa Reds with Talk To Me, and they're a Tassie act. You with the Dice Men cometh on Edge Radio 99.3 FM. Leon!
Yes!
Your turn to do some talking in the old yakety-yak on the old yak box.
Speaking of yaks, this game is all about, well, the yak's not his hairy cousin, the cow. We're talking about Khan of Khan.
Oh, Khan.
Yeah, Khan. So this is a game, very Australian. This is a game that was on Kickstarter. It wanted 10,000. It got nearly 50,000, 1,300 backers. It was done by Chaosium Inc., which are mainly known for their Lovecraftian stuff. So when you see this game, you think, what on earth is Chaosium doing putting this out? But they did. The game design is from our good friend, Mr. Reiner Knizia. Mr. isn't just as nice. Either way, so obviously, Medici, Ra, everything on his BGG page. There is 54 pages of games that he's been involved in over the last 30 odd years, so he's done a few. And the art by one of our absolute favourites, Ian O'Toole, gallerist Lisboa, just an awesome dude all around.
Not a doctor, though.
No, not a doc. Yeah, come on, Ian, pull finger, honestly. It's set in the Glorantha, and I've probably gotten that wrong.
No, you've got it right.
No, that's perfect.
World, which is the same world as the RuneQuest RPG and the HeroQuest board game.
Yeah,
this is
it,
which blew my mind when I read that, because I read it twice and went, that can't be right. Because this game has some lovely art by Ian that is very kind of kiddie. But either
sure
way.
Is.
So it's a fast-paced family game for 2 to 5 families. 2 to 5 families? 2 to 5 players. But you
families
can
all choose one person to represent their clan.
Yeah, possibly. So players are Khans of different fantastical tribes.
Khan.
Khan, indeed. On the plains of Prax, each riding a unique animal that has special abilities. Everyone attempts to amass the biggest herds while fighting off enemy magic stampedes and attempt by other players to steal their cows.
Because
it's all about having the most cows. So the way it works is players take turn to raid different locations. There is a little board in the centre, which doesn't really need to be there, but it's got Eno 2 art, so it can happily be there. You've got 10 different stacks of cards, and all your turn is basically picking one of those cards from one of those stacks. It is that simple.
That's the game.
And in those stacks, you have different kinds of cards with values of cows. There's 50s, 100s, 20s. There's also things like enemy magic, which makes you discard cards. There's tribal champions, which protects you. There's stampedes, which makes your most expensive cows bugger off, because you don't want
that one.
But yeah, that's what happens. So each player cow cards are placed in front of them, and what you can do on your turn, instead of picking up a card, is to corral them. You have a certain amount of corrals, and different characters will have different amounts, and throughout the game you have a certain amount of cards in front of you. You choose to corral them, and then they are in there forever and they can't go away. And at the end of the game, whoever has the most cows, be it in their corrals or left in their hand, on the playing field, which are still, you know, could be taken out by other cards, but if you get to the end and they're still there, person with the most cows is the winner.
Correct. And that's pretty much all there is to it.
Yes.
You draw a card, you do the thing that it says. If it's good for you, great. If it's bad for you, boo-hoo. Yeah. The various tribes have various special abilities. It all works. It's all a very kids' game. You'll play the game in about 15 minutes.
Yes. Yeah, so we played this at the pub with 4 men with a collective age of about 200 or so. So probably not for us, even though, you know, it was fine, but your turn was pick a card from one of these 10 stacks or corral your cards, and pretty much the game played itself.
It is
now,
as super light as you
can. Garth, did you play this with the youngins?
Yeah, I did, and they had a bit of fun with it.
Yes.
Again, they enjoyed flipping over, going, ah, or ooh, or cows. And that's about it. It's not one of those games you're going to sit down and play 25 times.
You wouldn't think so.
It has replayability in that there are a few more factions that you can choose from, and the 10 decks, they're all virtually the same, but each one has one unique card in it. And look, it looks great. It's light, it's small, it's compact, it's over and done with really quickly. There's nothing wrong with it. It's not offensive.
And I another thing to show how versatile Ian O'Toole is, because I looked at this and I went, this is Ian O'Toole, but it's sort of kitty and beautiful, gorgeous, but it's really kitty style and so different from anything I've ever seen of his. But it looks lovely. And, yeah, the whole Glorantha thing, like, why Chaosium produced a game.
It was their first foray into board gaming.
And now they've done the a Cthulhu-themed one, which they've done the on Kickstarter recently. But, yeah, really interesting as to this is their game. Anyway.
We're out of here.
We are out of time.
It's amazing how quickly this hour goes.
Yeah. Well, we'll be back next week to talk more games.
You've been listening to another episode of The Dice Men Cometh. Thanks to Area 52, Hobart's best ventilated game store, and more. Find out more on area52.com.au. They support the Dice Men, and you can too, at Patreon, for as little as just $1 per month. It's not a lot to ask for podcasting gold.